Because when we're looking at development deals, we're offering a 8% pref, but it's accrued, right? Because we don't want to borrow the pref to pay you a pref every month. So what we know is we know that it's going to accumulate. And if that deal takes 16 months versus 20 months, you're going to accrue more of a pref. I also agree that development should pay a higher return because you are waiting on your money. You're not getting cash flow, and cash flow is convenience.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show today. I'm so excited to introduce our amazing guest today, Shannon Robnett. Shannon, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate you inviting me.
Absolutely. So everyone, Shannon is based in the Boise area. He's been there for over 35 years, second generation builder and developer. He's a fourth generation realtor. He is involved in over $250 million in construction projects, ranging from multifamily, office buildings and municipal buildings to schools, industrial projects, and mini storage. He has a history of over $140 million in successful developments, and he has currently under management over $100 million with a wide range of investors. Well, that is quite the background and experience that you have, Shannon. Thanks so much for being here. Will you please share with us how you got to where you are today?
Well, thanks for that introduction. You know, the reality is I started young. I mean, I grew up in a household where my dad building buildings and my mom was selling buildings, right? So when I was 19 years old, everybody was talking about this new book that came out that was changing the investment world called Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So I had to read it. And when I read it, I didn't know what was so groundbreaking about it because that was how I was raised, right? I mean, my dad built buildings and the sticks and stones of the buildings became magic when you put the tenant in there and you created the cash flow, right? In that book, Robert Kiyosaki talks about creating cash flow in our lives that pay all of our bills. Well, that's the way my parents had built their business. And by the time they were 50, they retired, right? And so I saw that growing up and I was on a job working with my dad on a project and I got to know my crane operator and he was looking for a yard. He was looking for a place to park all of his cranes and he wanted something that was cheap and that something that was kind of close by where we were building. And I also got to know the neighbor lady next door. And she was in her late 70s and she had a son with some special needs. And they realized that it was time to get off this 5-acre parcel that they had and move somewhere where they could both be together until mom passed and somewhere that would take care of him. So I kind of put two and two together and I put that piece of property under contract with my only $500. It wasn't my last $500. It was the only money I had, right? And I put that property under contract and I did what I didn't know was a flip, but I did a flip and I made $100,000 there. And I looked at my dad who was paying a lot less than that at the time. And I said, I think I can do this instead of that. And so I just gradually knew that that was what I was going to do. And I began to build and I began to develop and I began to be the problem solver for people. And in that, I really found my calling and found where I wanted to go when I grew up. Ta-da, here I am today, all grown up.
Awesome. So where did you go from there? I mean, you're a developer now. When did you start developing? Was that your calling?
Well, yeah. I mean, that property, you know, it needed to be annexed into the city. And then, you know, from there, I started working with, I still had a real heavy background in construction. And that's what my dad did most of. And so I started working with clients that would come to me and say, hey, I need a 50,000 square foot building, but I have a really small budget and I need it to be this and I need it to be that. And so then we would begin designing and building those projects, right? We did that with police stations. We did that with schools. We did that all over. And from there, I just saw where, wait a minute, I'm doing this for everybody else. I can start doing this for me. And so then I started finding small infill lots and building industrial buildings on it, or developing, you know, a 10 acre parcel into 9 commercial lots. And so I just began to do that. And then, you know, it got bigger and it got bigger, and it became 40 acre parcels, and it became 100 lot subdivisions. It just kind of evolved, you know, 180 unit apartment complexes. And then I began to run out of money, right? I mean, there was my partners. I had a couple of partners that each one was in a different deal, and they were comfortable writing a check for maybe $1 million, maybe $1.5 million. You know, I had one partner that on our last project was 180 units, wrote a check for about $12 million. But, you know, that was kind of a family office situation, and the family office dissolved and they all went their separate ways. And so I had to go find more money, and that's kind of where I got into the syndication process. And so that's kind of my journey, where it just kind of, you know, like any bad habit, except real estate's a good habit, right? You just need more and more and more. And as that grew, I just found people found my skill set to be of value. And so I just continued to build on the brand.
Awesome. So let's talk about development. You know, I mean, our kind of bread and butter is value add. Let's talk about some of the differences, why you like ground up, et cetera.
Well, I found that there really are basically, there's two kinds of investors, right? There's the investor that wants to get appreciation out of their money, and there's the investor that wants cash flow. And the easiest way to put that is I'm the appreciation investor and my dad's the cash flow investor, right? Because if I got a 6% return on what I have now in a pile, I don't have enough to support the lifestyle I'm accustomed to, right? Whereas my dad has a lifestyle that fits the 7% return on the pile of cash he's got, right? Well, in a typical value add, you put both of those people in the blender and you say, hey guys, we have a deal and we're going to do this deal and it's going to be great. It's value add. And it's a $10 million property that we're going to buy at 5% under value. So we're going to buy it at $9.5 million. The bad news is we got to put $2.5 million in it, changing it from the Three Palms to the Tropicana. We're going to repaint the clubhouse. We're going to put some new gym equipment in there, put new deck chairs by the pool, and everything's going to be great. And we're going to force that appreciation. And then we're going to get this 8% cash on cash. And at the end of the day, we're going to get a 15% IRR and everybody's going to be happy. But the truth is, not everybody's happy. In fact, nobody's ever happy at the same time, because when we buy the deal, I'm going to be thrilled because we got the deal. Now we're going to add value. Man, we took that $10 million project, and as soon as we got all the painting done and all the new gym equipment and we forced that appreciation, we made money. And we took that $10 million investment and now it's worth $13 million. The problem is, it goes to the cash flow side of the deal. And I hate that part, right? I'm getting these checks and I don't need checks. I need millions, right? That's not enough. I'm getting an 8% return. I need more money. But my dad is thrilled, right? Because he needs motorhome fuel and dog food, right? He needs the cash flow to support his life because all his bills are paid with his cash flow. So he's thrilled for the next 3 to 5 years as we operate this thing and we get our 5% returns and all this stuff that I hate. Right? I'm done with this. I don't like this. And then the day comes that I get to be happy again. It's time for him to stop being happy. It's time for me. It's my time. We're selling it, right? And we do. We sell it. And then there's the money. We made our $17 million and everybody gets paid and yay, but we're never happy at the same time. And I realized that in construction, because as you know, when you build the building, you got the sticks and stones and you build the building and that's great, but it's really putting the tenants in it that adds the original value, right? And I'll give you an example, because today is a phenomenal day because we actually had a closing today. And I'll give you the example of that closing. This was a 36 unit apartment complex that we built for $5.3 million. The appraisal said it was going to be worth $6.3 million when it was done. So I found a lender that would loan me $3.5 million, and I needed to raise $1.8 million. And so I rounded up friends and family, and I got my syndication partners all together. We raised that $1.8 million, and I promised them 35% of the deal when we hit that $6.3 million, right? Well, as we all know, in the 14 months it took us to build that, we faced all kinds of adversities with COVID and lumber prices and all this stuff. But the great news was we prevailed. We came out on top, and we sold that project today for $7 million. Right? Yay. Everybody's happy because we were all in the appreciation game together. We put the tenants in, we made the appreciation happen, and we sold that to the other group that wants the cash flow. And they're thrilled too, because they have this brand new asset that all it needs is the tender loving care of a great property management company to harvest those pretty little paychecks or those rent checks and pay the bills. And we've got warranties and we've got brand new HVAC units and we've got sidewalks that don't need repairs. And we've got all the perfect things that my dad wants, right? And that's become my business model, so that we do that, and we do that in a fashion that's repeatable, so that my appreciation guys can continue to repeat. Did I tell you how long we had it? We had it for 14 months, so we can 1031 out of it, right? They're going to hold it for 10 years. So they're going to hold it 10, 15 years. They're going to get some really great HUD financing on it that's going to take them off into the sunset, and they're going to have phenomenal cash flow. So that's really kind of the business model that I've evolved out of that. Kind of keeps everybody happy, but you never invite the same people to the same party.
I really, really love how you explain that, because it's been kind of going on in the back of my head for a while. Like, you know, why would this appeal to this person? And, you know, maybe this isn't, and you're just not making everybody, I don't know. Yeah, it's just you're kind of mixing it all together. And anyway, so I really love how you explained that. Thank you, Shannon.
No worries. But, you know, that's been my reality, because as you've known, when you pitch the deal, there's people that look at it and go, yeah, I'd totally do the deal if it did this. I'd totally do the deal, but your timeline's too long. Your timeline's too short. Your returns are not enough. Your returns are whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. It's always not right for somebody, right? What I learned in my younger days of probably trying to make my parents happy with who I was as a kid growing up was that you can't please everybody with the same thing. So get different things for those different people, right?
Yeah, for sure. So what kinds of cash flows, just for my understanding, are you able to provide once you sell the building?
Sure. So the reality is when we transact on that, we're getting an 8% cash on cash with a modeled out 3% appreciation on the product as we go. We're financing those with HUD product called a 223F, which is a 35-year amortized loan that is non-recourse. It's 100% assumable. I mean, it's a fantastic loan, right? I mean, it's such a sweet loan. I mean, I wouldn't loan my brother money at that and let alone for 35 years. And I love him, right? But it's a sweet loan and it's beautiful. And a lot of people in the value add space, they go, I don't want to do that because the fees are pretty high, right?
And it takes a year to close.
Well, not on the 223. That's on the 223 D4.
Okay.
23F is a 90 days of stabilization at 90% occupancy is what the regulation is, because they're not underwriting it to that point to loan you the money to build it, right? And the problem with the 223 D4 was you did that as a pre-construction thing. And if you didn't do that, then you had to have it stabilized for a full 3 years before you could come back and underwrite it that way. Well, HUD saw that as the problem, so they've changed that a little bit. But the thing that made that expensive on a value add was because the timeline was only a 3 to 5 or maybe a 7 to 10 year hold. And those were a lot of fees to pay when you're only holding that long. Mm-hmm. And the reality was a building that was built in the 70s is really probably going to need to be refreshed every 7 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. If you're taking a brand new building now, you won't need to refresh it for 15, if at all, in the first 20, right? So you can take that thing out 20 of the 35-year life, have a completely assumable loan that you could then sell on the secondary market and have that assumption be a fantastic thing, because where rates are at right now, mm-hmm. as you know, they're not going to stay.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks for explaining some of those things. So, you know, I know in some ways you prefer, or you think it's potentially, did you say less risky development than value add? Can you talk about that?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
So let's go back to my analogy there where we bought the three palms and we're converting it to the Tropicana, right? We paid $9.5 million for a $10 million asset, but then we spent $2 million on it, right? When we're done with our CapEx, as a lot of people found in the first part of 2020, let's just say that you bought that Tropicana in October of 2019, right? In Orlando, Florida, right? And by April of 2020, you had expended all your CapEx. You were ready to go. And they closed Disney World. I mean, who closes Disney World, right? Now your people are out of work. Nobody's coming to town. Orlando turns into a ghost town, right? I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on that's not good. And now all of a sudden you're starting to panic because now you took a $10 million asset. You spent, now you're into this thing, $11.5 million. You're over your skis. And maybe you didn't collect enough reserves because now you've got all the money spent and the tenants aren't there. You're not getting the appreciation. Heck, you're lucky if you can keep the ones in there you got paying, right? So things can be very risky there. And it's assumed that since it had cash flow with it when you bought it, it must be a good deal. Let's look at construction for a minute, okay? When we did our deal that we just closed on today, $5.3 million, the bank said, hey, Shannon, how long do you think it's going to take to build this building? I said, well, I think it's going to take 9 to 11 months. Okay, we're going to put in an 18-month interest reserve. And I go, 18 months? Man, that seems like a lot of money. You know, I mean, they go, well, let's say it takes 11 months to build, and then it takes you, you know, twice as long as you think to fill it. Well, I think we're going to fill it in 3 months. Okay, so now let's say it takes 6 months. So here we are. We're 17 months. Let's just throw on another one. We'll make it 18 months. That's all factored into my loan because the bank knows that my asset is not going to be producing money until it gets all the way to the end, right? So the assumption is that I have reserves set aside in an adequate fashion and that I am going to have zero cash flow until the last 3 months of my project, where when you buy a value add, it's assumed that you have cash flow all along. Mm-hmm. So when something like COVID hits right at the end of your CapEx expenditure, that can be fatal, right? And so when I look at that, I say, well, I get it. You believe that that cash flow that you're buying is worth it. But I'll also tell you that when we're selling at $7 million that we built for $5.3 million, the only difference is that we created that cash flow. So we harvested that $2.5 million, right? And that's the difference between buying cash flow and selling cash flow, right? Mm-hmm. So when you buy that value add, you're paying top dollar for it because you're paying for that cash flow. When you're building, you're creating that original value add, but you're doing it with an interest reserve that's built in by the bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. I mean, it's, you know, oftentimes there's talk of how development is more risky and, you know, so you should get a higher return for it. And some of those risks are like...
I do agree with the higher return because when we're looking at development deals, we're offering a 8% pref, but it's accrued, right? Because we don't want to borrow the pref to pay you a pref every month. So what we know is we know that it's going to accumulate. And if that deal takes 16 months versus 20 months, you're going to accrue more of a pref. I also agree that development should pay a higher return because you are waiting on your money. You're not getting cash flow, and cash flow is convenience, right? Mm-hmm. So we do pay a higher return. In fact, our investors on that last deal made 31% on an annualized basis, right? That's a pretty good return for 14 months on your money annualized. So it was a little over the total IRR was about 32.5, 33%, right?
Yeah,
so it does pay better because it is development. It just doesn't pay cash flow, right? Mm-hmm.
For sure. Yeah. I'm glad you touched on that. I mean, I didn't necessarily think you didn't think, but yeah. So what about some of the major risks that people associate with development, like construction risk, entitlement risk, the sort of delays that can happen for various reasons?
And those are real, right? And those are real. But like I said before, we can mitigate those if you know how to properly construct your team. Let's talk about the two different sides of the coin, right? So on the one hand, you've got the team that says, we're going to bid this out. We're taking low bid. We're getting the best price. And we're going to ride this contractor like a rented pony. And we're going to get the best value we can out of him, right? Well, the minute that you do that, you went to an architect and you hired an architect and he drew you the Taj Mahal, right? And the contractor comes back and he says, wow, that Taj Mahal is going to cost you $25 million. And you go, ooh, I got a budget of 23. Contractor says, okay, let me see what I can do. He goes back and he comes back and he says, okay, I can do it for 23. Okay. Then they start going through it. And then all of a sudden you start to see these things called change orders. Well, you know what? They forgot this. And oh, by the way, we didn't think you wanted that level of this. It's called out that. By the way, they spec'd out this elevator. This elevator is discontinued. The next elevator is another $100,000. And you start to see these change orders and things start to get bad, right? Because now you're right at the top of your budget, your contingency's blown in the first couple of months, and you still have another 12-month marriage to this general contractor because you're trying to get it done as cheap as possible and he's trying to make as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And really the flaw started at the absolute very beginning. So I'll tell you what we do. When I go to build a building, when I look at a piece of property and I fall in love with this beautiful piece of green pasture that I want to convert into a high rise, right? The first thing I do is I call my property management guy and I say, hey, Jeff, I'm here at such and such And I'm looking at probably 200 units. I'm looking at garden style, three-story. I'm looking at clubhouse. I'm looking at these amenities. What do you think I can get for it? And Jeff says, give me a couple of days and I'll give you a market study. So he comes back with a market study and says our average rent is $1,600 bucks a month. So then I go to my construction management guy and I said, what can I get for $1,600 bucks a month? And we start drawing plans based on that. But we also involve our subcontractors. So we know that the plumbing is 13.2% of the deal, right? That's just what it costs when it comes to construction. So we put that in there. We know that our cap rate on our rent, say that we have this much to build with. We know that our plumber gets this much a door. So when we begin the development of the plans, the plumber's at the table with the architect, right? The heating and air guys in there, they're all giving their input because they're designing their budget. Mm-hmm. He knows he's only got $2 million to do all 180 units and he doesn't have a penny more because he knows if he messes up on the plans, it's not my fault. Mm-hmm. And it's not the architect's fault, it's his, mm-hmm. right? So you get their buy-in from the beginning. Then we go to the general contractor and we go, hey, listen, instead of this change order game, instead of beating each other up over a dollar and trying to figure out how much of your money I can steal and your money we can trade, let's just make it a cost plus. And everybody goes, oh, no, not the dreaded cost plus, where the contractor can charge you another $10,000 for something and make a percentage on it. Well, he can, but he has to have a legitimate reason why the subcontractor that drew the plans that he hired, everybody that was involved screwed up somehow, and now it's going to cost you more money. And of that, he makes a 5 or 6 or 7% additional increase. So a $10,000 change order would make him $500. Well, that doesn't sound like that's going to be a real reality, does it? And so then all of a sudden, the whole makeup of the team changes, right? So now the general contractor has said, hey, before we go to this, does a $23 million budget work? You say, yes, that works. You say, okay, we built in our contingencies. The subcontractors have already bid it because they designed it. Everything is good. We're to the $23 million. Oh, by the way, we already know what kind of countertops we have. We already know what kind of doorknobs and plumbing fixtures and lighting and all that, because that was all designed and spec'd in. And so now the whole flavor of your job changes. And now you do have unknowns that you can have to deal with, like bad soil or lumber prices going up, but they're very small in comparison to a normal general contractor setup where the negotiation happens and then the brawl starts. And it's just this side of a lawsuit that we all settle out and walk away.
Yeah. So do you basically function as your own construction manager?
Right. So we are everything to ourselves, right? I mean, I really believe that a vertically integrated company is the best company. So when I needed a project property management company, I just went out and hired the best guy I could find in town and started my own company to manage the properties I wanted my way. But I have an outside company that does that. I have the general construction firm. I've got the development where we're doing all of our entitlements. And then we deal with also the real estate acquisition and disposition of all of our properties as well. So we are vertically integrated top to bottom. And then we raise our own funds if we can find enough.
Yeah, for sure. Interesting. And so just a question. So in Boise, I mean, you mentioned 1600. I don't know if that's actually where rent's at. Is that, what would you consider that affordable? Do you know where it sits in the area median income? If it's like,
well, you know, affordable is like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder, right? I mean, but the reality is the average median 3-bedroom, 2-bath in Boise, Idaho right now is going to run right around that $1,600 mark. Mm-hmm. And you can go affordable from there. You can go, you know, luxury from there. You can go kind of anywhere. But the reality is if we know that we've got $1,600 of a door for rent, we know what we can be on our build price. We know we've got to be $185,000 finished to make all the other numbers work to fit in there. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you from the time I get my rent study from my property management guy, I can tell you in 2 days if we can build a project or not based on what the city's going to require for entitlements, what the landowner wants for the land and what my construction team is going to charge for construction, right? So we can make decisions pretty quick based on having the rent number and working backwards.
That's really great. And so it sounds like you're developing in Boise for the most part, right? Since your team is based in Boise.
We are in a target-rich environment. We have plenty of dirt and tons of demand. You know, we're sitting there with a 16% rent growth year over year, 9% the previous 4 years, and a 2% vacancy rate. It doesn't make a lot of sense to start looking at other markets, but I am looking at a couple of deals in the Tri-Cities area and a couple of deals in the Portland area.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I also wanted to get a sense of like what kind of percentage the, you know, when you said you've taken care of most of the unknowns, Like when you think about the price of lumber going up, it's really easy for your mind to kind of like spiral and be like, well, it's like doubled and it's going to like quadruple. So like, how do you go ahead and quantify those risks?
Well, you know, and lumber is a great example because lumber has done something that lumber's never done in history, right? I mean, we are in process now on a 191 unit apartment complex. It's right about $50 million deal. And we needed to raise $15 million in capital on that deal. And during that time period, we went from $350 a thousand on lumber to where we sit today at $1,700, right? So that's five times, right? Mm-hmm. We locked in our lumber price right about $1,100 a thousand. Mm-hmm. So we locked in at triple our lumber number. And that lumber number was at $3 million in the cost of our project. Mm-hmm. So triple that, we're now at $9 million, right? So we got a $6 million cost overrun. Mm-hmm. We haven't even started yet, mm-hmm. right? But the reality is we looked at it, we said, okay, wait a minute. We had a $6 million cost overrun. What happened to rents? Well, rents went up 16% last year. Mm-hmm. So we looked at that, we reshuffled the deck and we said, okay, listen, where are we at today at today's rents, right? So we looked at that. We went back to our investors and we said, okay, guys, we're ready to go. We are like, it's D-Day. We are going tomorrow. Here's the thing. We're going to need to raise another $1 million in capital because we need to bring in another $8 million in borrowed money to cover this deficit. And that's going to do A, B, and C to it. It actually increased the returns a little bit because the rents went up more, right? But it gives you opportunities to look at that. The other thing that we do have is we do have a 7% contingency built into the deal. So on a $42 million construction cost, 7% contingency allows you some room to cover that kind of stuff, right? So we had about $3 million in contingency already. We just didn't want to spend it before we even broke ground. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Okay, thanks for sharing that story. And one more question that's just on my mind before we wrap up, which is, so, you know, you're doing multifamily. We just had COVID. People are obviously looking for more. I mean, things are changing, right? They're looking for more space. How does that affect your interest in building multifamily?
Well, you know, the reality is, so there's a lot of things that happened during COVID. And one of the things that we dealt with was we dealt with people that couldn't pay their rent, right? Let's just talk about one of the big elephants in the room. There's several in that question, by the way. But one of them was, and this is why I thought it was so awesome to have my own company that did this, because I'm really proud of what they did. By the time I figured out what they were doing, it was already done. There was one particular lady, her name is Wendy. And Wendy heard about some of our tenants that were struggling to pay their rent. And so Wendy went and found all the rent assistance that was available in our area. The problem with rent assistance programs is none of them are really easy and streamlined. And it's not like you just show up and go, hi, my name's Shannon. I'm late on my rent. Can I have some money? And they give you money. There's all these documents you got to do. But once you've done it once, you're repeating the process. So Wendy was able to, in a day and a half, service about 15 of our clients and get them on a rental assistance program. And now we're thrilled because we're getting our full rent. They're thrilled because their rent's covered and they're no longer stressed out about it. And everybody wins in that situation, right? But the other thing that happened too in COVID is everybody looked at a lot of things differently. And so when you're in the Boise, Idaho market, you've got people pouring in from California and Oregon and Washington because they don't like the political climate, the lockdowns, all those other things. So they're coming to Idaho or they're going all the way to North Dakota with the young lady up there that was the governor that never locked anything down. So we had a lot of political refugees moving into our area based on what they saw that they didn't like around there. So we saw actually a greater influx of people moving in from out of state during COVID than we did in any of the previous 5 years, percentage-wise, in growth. And we were all supposed to be in a lockdown.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you're just constantly thinking on your feet and making the best of whatever's in front of you, which I definitely appreciate. And that's kind of what's fun about business, right? It is. Yeah, totally. Well, Shannon, we are at the end of our time. I'm sure we could continue on for quite a long time, but please for now, give the listeners a way to contact you and anything else you'd like to share.
Sure. Well, thank you again so much for letting me come on your show and talk to your listeners. I do appreciate the time and the trust, but you can just find me anywhere in the great wide world wide web. You can find me at shannonrobnett.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, Instagram, all those kinds of normal places. You can find me on Facebook, but shannonrobnett.com is the easiest place to connect with me at.
Awesome. Well, I hope you guys find Shannon, look at some of his projects. Thanks so much again, Shannon, for coming on. Can't wait to have you on again and see what's new in your world then. Thanks and take care.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.